This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. You can now watch our show on Free Speech TV every weekday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. FSTV is on Dish Network, DirecTV, and Roku. One of the nation's preeminent feminist authors, Susan Faludi, has just written a book about her father called In the Dark Room. Faludi's journey began in 2004 when her father, whom she remembered as a patriarchal man who left her mother, contacted her and asked her to write the story of his transition from male to female. The resulting book is not just an exploration of her personal relationship with the woman who her father became, but an attempt at reconciling who he once was with his gender transition. Faludi hails from that generation of second-wave feminists who rejected traditional gender norms, which complicated attempts at solidarity with trans women who embraced those roles. It is her exploration of that aspect of her father's story that is the most fascinating. Susan Faludi is a prize-winning journalist and best-selling author of Backlash, The Undeclared War Against American Women, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award. She's also written Stiffed, The Betrayal of the American Man, and The Terror Dream, Myth and Misogyny in an Insecure America. And she also has written for The New York Times, The New Yorker, and Harper's. She recently joined me in person while on book tour to discuss her new book, In the Dark Room. Welcome to the program, Susan Faludi.
Thank you so much.
So I have to confess, I'm a little starstruck. I read your book, Backlash, in the early 90s, and you know, it was very much influential in my politics. As soon as I saw that you'd written a new book and were available for interviews, I jumped at the chance. And then I looked at the topic of the book and I thought, wow, this is even better than I expected. How is it that someone like yourself, who's written the kind of very, very crucial socio-political commentary in your last three books, has now written this very personal story? If you can kind of take us on the journey that brought you to this book, which actually goes back well over a decade, right?
Yes, yeah. It all started in 2004. When I got an email from my father, sent from Hungary, where my father was living at the time, and it was captioned, "Changes." My father wrote a very brief note that said, basically, "Dear Susan, I have some interesting news for you. I have decided I've had enough of impersonating this macho, aggressive man that I've never been inside." And it turned out the interesting news was that my father had flown to Thailand without telling anyone in the family and had sex reassignment surgery and had become a woman. So naturally, this surprised me on many levels. Above the obvious, my father was 76 years old at the time. And beyond that, my father and I had barely spoken for more than a quarter century, precisely because my father was indeed a macho, aggressive man when I was growing up, as well as controlling and domineering and even violent, all of which I discuss in the book, and all of which fueled my early feminism.
Right. In fact, that to me is such a fascinating question before we even get to the story, that that when you wrote Backlash about how women are perceived in the media, about how feminism was seen as this terrible thing for women, that you had this background, you were part of a family where you witnessed firsthand the ravages of patriarchy and the damage that patriarchy does. So now here, all these years later, is your father in a way rejecting that self? But did he even acknowledge that he was that way?
Well, my father is a very hidden person, I think hidden even from herself. And I sense that growing up, we all in the family sense that there was, my father was always sort of putting on these kind of masks, these disguises. And the main disguise was as a kind of frenetic sportsman and an imperious patriarch. You know, there in the living room was the chair, the armchair that only he could sit in, and we always had to ask permission for anything we could do. He forbade my mother to work, and it was based, we never knew when he was going to blow up, when we were all pretty afraid of him. Now, looking back, I wonder how much of that kind of extreme hyper-masculinity was just an effort to paper, you know, to hide what my father felt much more deeply.
And in fact, can we then take lessons? I know it's hard to extrapolate from an example of one, but do you get the sense that much of patriarchy does stem from an inner fear of revealing one's true self?
Well, you know, what's interesting was that I, after Backlash, I wrote this book on masculinity called Stiffed, which was all about that. Did I apply it to my own backyard? No, but although I did send a copy of the book to my father, who, you know, sent some polite email back. But so much of what I wrote about in Stiffed was that it isn't just women who are stuck in these gender stereotyped molds. It's men too, and it's in many ways even more stifling and confining for men. So I'm somewhere in the back of my mind, perhaps I was thinking about my father.
So your father said, I have had the surgery. Your father contacted you post-surgery after he had become a woman. And then you had to adjust in your mind pronouns and how you even saw your father. But you said you had sort of lost touch with your father altogether. Why did she want you to write her story? Some, you know, a daughter who had been out of her life.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it was because of the violence, that my father's violence, that I sort of, you know, pulled away from my father, and my father equally pulled away from me because I had taken my mother's side in all this. I mean, I was, you know, the 17-year-old rah-rah feminist. I was outraged by all of this and sympathetic to my mother, and my father didn't like that. So over the years, you know, we would see each other at a, you know, formal family event on rare occasions, you know, one wedding, one graduation, and sort of minimal email contact, but that was about it.
And so what made you take on this project then? And did you feel that when you started it in 2004, that the work you did in writing Backlash and Stiffed would play into this?
Well, you know, I felt, well, to start at the beginning of it, my father asked me to you know, when we talked on the phone the first time after the email, my father said, write my story. And I very much wanted to be back in contact and sensed that my father did too. But beyond that, I, you know, I'm a writer. I write to try and figure out what I'm thinking and to figure out my relationship with my father. And one step further, I felt I really couldn't go forward in writing about gender issues without admitting to my own experience. Mm-hmm. So all of that was in the mix. And I think it was a way, for many years, I didn't know if I was going to publish this. It was more something I was doing with my father. And it was a way to reconnect with my father and to ask a lot of personal questions. You know, I had my notebook and my tape recorder, and it was my own mask, my own guise of how to be in the world by being a journalist. And that gave me some kind of courage to probe further.
What was it like to meet your father for that first time after his surgery?
Well, it wasn't, you know, it took some getting used to, for sure. But I have to say, you know, my father wearing a dress, that aspect of it, it kind of, you know, it didn't shock me, or it very quickly just became the new normal. Mm-hmm. I think what was much harder for me to accept were all the ways that my father hadn't changed. Oh. And all the baggage between us, and that in spite of the dress, my father was still very aggressive, very controlling, and volcanic in her anger. Mm-hmm. the one difference was she was aware of it and struggling with it and hoping that by being a woman, she could get a handle on that. So there was something to work with, which made it different.
And I thought this was one of the most fascinating parts of your book, that when you were doing the research, and of course, you know, started this in 2004, and today we have much more awareness of the politics of the transgender community. The transgender community in general is much more visible today. They're on TV. We have trans actors. We have, you know, Caitlyn Jenner.
Parent.
yeah. And so, but at the time, you write in your book of the research that you tried to do on gender transitions historically and what you found troubled you. Tell me what it, you know, a little bit about that, that for you as a feminist who rejected this notion of traditional gender norms, you were finding that people who transitioned from male to female were sort of clinging harder to those traditional gender norms because they identified that with being a woman, with being submissive, with being a woman, et cetera.
Well, after I first went over to Budapest to see my father, and I should say here, my father herself at this point was extremely enamored of a kind of Doris Day 1950s femininity. That combined with a kind of Hungarian folk costume, which was its own sort of caricature, lots of ribbons and embroidery, and my father was full of such adages as, it's wonderful being a woman, you get taken care of, men always kiss my hand, which is this Hungarian expression, kész egy csókolom, which is what a gentleman says to a lady. And of course, I'm sitting there thinking, well, that's not really been my experience of being a woman, that men are just rushing to kiss my hand and open doors. And, you know, over time, that abated with my father. My father, once she became more sort of comfortable with herself, she let go of that cliche. But after I spent after that first trip to Budapest, I came back home and I ensconced myself in the public library and was reading whatever the library had, which at the time was not a lot. And the trans memoirs they had tended to be an older set. And basically they were memoirs by mostly transsexuals of my father's generation, which may be why, and again, I saw this sort of exaltation of the stiletto and, you know, kind of push-up bra version of womanhood, you know, kind of a pin-up girl. But as I continued researching, it soon, you know, this is now, you know, 2004, and in the starting in the early 90s, there was a whole new movement of transgender studies, and people like Sandy Stone, Susan Stryker, who said, wait a second, by trans, we don't mean just flipping from one side of the binary to the other. We mean, you know, disrupting the binary itself, transcending gender. Which to my mind was very much in accord with my own feminism, which, you know, my fundamental feminist belief is that gender is fluid on a continuum, you know, that we're all more complex than the sex roles that society imposes on us.
Right. And in fact, those roles confine us.
Absolutely. And confine both women and men. You know, it's the same story on the masculine end of the spectrum, that we've, you know, cut off a whole range of emotions, feelings, behaviors, desires.
If you're just tuning in, and speaking with the best-selling author Susan Faludi about her new book, In the Dark Room. The title, In the Dark Room, refers, I think, to the fact that your father started out as a photographer obsessed with cameras. Tell us about that aspect of your father, and whether this idea of capturing images also was part of her story.
Yes. Well, my father was a particular kind of photographer. My father literally spent then his life in the dark room. My father, back when I was growing up, was a high-end commercial photographic developer, did a lot of work for Condé Nast, so for beauty and fashion magazines, doing color conversions, making the perfect copy of a print, montages, and in particular, my father was skilled at the art of manipulating photographs, techniques with the wonderfully metaphoric names of masking, dodging. You know, a writer couldn't make this stuff up. And worked with a lot of major fashion photographers, Bert Stern, Irving Penn, Francesca Scuvillo, Richard Avedon. And my father referred to this as my trick photography. And my father had a lifelong affair with manipulating images. And then when my father, even before my father's sex reassignment surgery, my father was manipulating photos of herself. She was one of the first fans of the selfie before we even had that name.
In this framework, does the darkroom, does it symbolize the closet?
Well, it symbolizes a lot of things. I mean, it symbolizes the sort of the unilluminated place where I felt my father lived when I was a child. It was the dark room I tried to pry open, and which my father finally opened herself when we reunited in Hungary in the 2000s. And I think, you know, it's the dark room we all live in with all of our parents who, you know, no matter, one might not have as an extreme and kind of exotic a story as my father's, but we all grow up kind of incarcerated with these people who we lived with day after day for all these years, and they're still really a mystery to us.
I'm wondering if you can read a section from your book In the Dark Room for our audience. And I should warn our audiences, it might be a little bit strong language here. But this is a section from Susan Faludi's new book, In the Dark Room.
And I should say here, this is, I'm reading a more political aspect of my book. I mean, there's lots of the personal between my father and me. But one of the things I had to come to terms with was, what is this thing we call identity? And one of the things I learned was how identity can either be liberating if it's a journey toward self-knowledge, as I think is the case with so many involved in LGBT rights or feminism or civil rights, or it can be this oppressive force when it's all about sort of denying one, you know, refusing to confront real problems and reckon with an ugly past. And in this case, we had those two in collision at the Gay Pride Parade in 2008 in Budapest, where rising right-wing ferment in the country had generated these kind of street paramilitary groups that were targeting Jews, were targeting the Roma. They're now targeting, you know, the refugees from Syria and elsewhere, and of course LGBT folks became the target of their wrath. So this is, and my father had gone to an earlier Gay Pride parade, and so this is about that. Maybe I can read it without these glasses. Let's see. Yes. Are you going to be in the parade? I asked. We were washing dishes in my father's kitchen. My father took her time drying her hands on her frilled yellow apron. No. Why not? I asked. We were talking about the one annual public showing of Hungary's LGBT population, the Budapest Gay Dignity Procession. The parade was scheduled for July 5th, a few weeks hence. I did it once, my father said. So? So, I don't need to do it again. It's boring. I didn't buy that. The Grand Dame of the Gay Parade, she'd exulted 2 years earlier after the 2006 march. Well, she said, she'd added, old dame, anyway. She'd sent me pictures she'd taken with young revelers, and she couldn't stop talking about it. It's the signature event of the LGBT community, I said. Don't you want to be there? She gave her signature wave of dismissal. It's an irritant. Some of the transes don't dress tastefully, you know? I didn't know. But I knew enough about the parade's reception to be secretly relieved she was planning on missing it. My father stacked the plates in the cupboard. She wiped down the counter slowly and took her time folding the matching yellow floral dish towels. Then she met my eye. There could be trouble, she said. The previous year, right-wing thugs had attacked the paraders as they marched down Andrashi Boulevard and beat up revelers at the after-party at Buda Beach, two so severely that they had to be hospitalized. The police were conspicuously absent. When a parade member called the police, she was told that, having chosen to participate in the march, she, quote, should take the consequences. On the streets of Budapest that day, two assertions of identity had collided, with bloody consequences for one of them. In the weeks leading up to this year's procession, the signs were even more ominous. The Hungarian right-wing media and blogosphere were roiling with fury. The quote-unquote communique issued by the rightist Hunia organization was typical. Quote, we will not permit aberrant foreigners of this or that color to force their alien and sick world on Hungary. We hereby publicly declare that we ourselves will defend the Hungarian capital. Jobbik parliamentary members, Jobbik is the right-wing party in Hungary, the far right, there are many right-wing parties, attempted to ban the parade and later introduced legislation to make the quote, promotion of sexual deviations, unquote, including, quote, homosexuality, transsexuality, transvestism, bisexuality, and pedophile behaviors, unquote, punishable by up to 8 years in prison. In June, the far-right website Kuruk posted the names and addresses of LGBT gathering spots in Budapest. A few days later, a gay bar and bathhouse, both on the website's list, were firebombed. Kuruk hailed the attacks in a post titled, Cleansing Fire Links Another Mini-Sodom. By then, more than a dozen Hungarian far-right groups were mobilizing against the march. The Hungarian Self-Defense Movement announced its intent to attack the parade and appealed to, quote, all Hungarians to expel the pederast horde once and for all. A soccer fan club promised to meet the marchers, quote, with weapons if we must, with bare hands if we must, but we will not let things stand as they are. The opening ceremonies of the 2008 Gay Pride Festival were held in a downtown theater. Former Equality Minister Catalin Levoyi delivered the keynote speech. She talked about the rights and the desires of LGBT people to build a community by making their, quote, identity public. A community, she said, quote, may only find dignity if it becomes visible. But the threat convinced many, like my father, to stay home. The day of the Gay Dignity procession, bands of self-styled Hungarian patriots broke through the police barricades and hurled smoke bombs, firecrackers, cobblestones, bottles, acid-filled eggs, rotted food, and feces. They accosted parade-goers and policemen alike, beat up a well-known liberal radio reporter, and attacked a Roma performer so viciously that the march's concert had to be canceled. They slapped and spat at a socialist politician who was on record as supporting the march and smashed the windows of the car carrying the former equality minister and the first openly gay government official. Marchers fled through an underground tunnel to the nearest subway station. In the course of the dignity procession, the predictable epithets were hurled. Dirty queers, filthy fags, quote, perverts, rotten hell, and so on. One particular chant, though, seemed to capture the crowd's fancy. It was heard all along the parade route. Buzakat aduna bo, zido kat meg utuno, which means, faggots into the Danube, followed by the Jews.
Susan Faludi reading from her book In the Dark Room. So we live in a world that the mainstream feels very threatened by any challenges to identity. We know here in the United States, transgender people face unprecedented levels of violence, also politically violence in terms of things like bathroom rights. But what you pointed out in that section I thought was really interesting. How important is the story of your father's Jewish heritage, given our history, and its links to her decision and her journey to becoming a woman?
Yeah, they're very inseparable. I mean, they're all tangled together. And I should mention that chant at the end of faggots into the Danube, followed by the Jews, is a reference to the fact that during World War II, thousands of Jews were taken to the Danube and shot into the river in the fall and winter of 1944. And any Hungarian knows what that's referring to. So it's a deeply anti-Semitic remark it's obviously a deeply anti-Semitic remark, but it's embedded in a very particular history. So the story of my father was my father grew up a Jewish boy in Budapest, the only son of wealthy parents. And my father lived this life of privilege with governesses and nannies until World War II, when large numbers of my family perished in the Holocaust. And my teenage father was suddenly, basically an urchin on the streets, living by his wits by passing as a Christian, armed with only false identity papers and a stolen fascist armband. My father actually used that armband at one point to rescue his parents by posing as a Hungarian Nazi Aero-Cross officer. So that trauma, at the age of between 13 and 17, infused everything else in my father's life. And my father was my father herself put together her experience of passing as a Christian with her a later effort to present as a woman, and told me over and over again that she felt that strangely enough, was good training for her to know how, as she loved to put it, how to get away with things. And she felt that, if I believe it in myself, then I can make other people believe it. So she put those two together. So they were always in conversation, which is not to say that one was causal. It's not like the Holocaust was some switch that flipped my father's gender. But I think it does speak to the fact that we aren't just one thing, that everything in our experience goes into what our so-called identity is.
And the Holocaust also basically targeted gays and lesbians and trans people too, right? I mean, I don't know specifically transgender people, but people who identified as not heterosexual, right?
Absolutely. And, there was a gendered aspect to how Jewish men were treated. Mm-hmm. There's a long history in Europe anti-Semitic slurs against Jewish men, implying that they are feminized, even to the degree of going back to the Dark Ages of saying Jewish men menstruated. And then on top of that, there's a gender dimension to what happened to Jewish men during the Holocaust, because if you're a woman and you had the identity papers, you might be able to get away with it and say, no, I'm a Christian. But Jewish men who were circumcised, as my father was, all it took was one, what they called trouser inspection, and you could be off to the gas chamber. So it was a very different experience being male during the war.
The before and after transition for your father? You knew who your father was from your childhood, and then you met your father when she identified as a woman, became a woman, even anatomically through the surgeries. But in that in-between, you discuss in your book a character named Mel, who knew about the in-between because he was in Thailand with your father. Tell us about this sort of mini industry, it turns out, in Thailand that basically offers gender reassignment surgeries for people who might not be able to afford to do it in their own homes or can't do it.
Well, yeah, I mean, Thailand is known for medical, I guess they call it medical tourism, which is sort of an odd term, but because there are a number of medical specialties that have, flowered in Thailand, and with that, where they have excellent hospital surgical care and much more affordable. And so my father, who remained a dual citizen of the U.S. and Hungary, could have gone to the U.S. and had the surgery done. At the time, it wasn't covered. So, I mean, ironically, some years later, Medicare, there was a government ruling that Medicare could cover sex reassignment surgery. But at the time, it would have been very, very expensive. So my father chose this route. And then after the surgery, because it's such an intensive surgery, you can't get on the plane right away. So this person who at the time was herself a trans woman, mm-hmm. who had gone from Mel to Melanie and ran this sort of rest home for post-op transsexuals to stay before they got on the airplane. So Melanie invited my father to stay in the cocoon. As it turned out, Melanie then moved part of the year, lived in Portland, Oregon, where I was living at the time. So the two of us met later, and Melanie told me all about that chapter in my father's life. But Melanie herself was a fascinating story because at the time I met her, she had actually gone back to calling herself Mel and was preparing to transition back to being a man, in particular because Melanie had a girlfriend in Thailand who she wanted to come to the United States and wanted to get a visa. And at the time, this is before same-sex marriage, they couldn't get married. Again, it's a story of there's your identity and what you think you are in isolation. And then there's, your connections with other people. And in Mel's case, this attachment to her girlfriend proved to be, a very powerful dynamic in making a decision about what gender to be.
What did your father make of this book that you wrote about her? Because it's, critical. may not have been what she expected. Probably she couldn't predict what you would write.
Well, it's funny because I had an actual working draft. And this was about a year before my father died. And so, and I called her up and said, I have a manuscript, I've showed it to my editor at the publishing house, they really like it, they want to publish it. And she was thrilled. And I said, it's the kind of warts and all treatment, and there are going to be things in here you won't like. And she said, oh, that's, she just kept saying, oh, how fantastic. Mm-hmm. And then never wanted, never asked to see it.
So she never read it?
No, she never read it. And I've, pondered that because my father was so controlling through so much.
She asked you to write this.
Yes. And, you know, I think, and I can't read my father's mind, but I think what she really wanted in the end was to be perceived and to be seen whole, even the not so nice parts. And she knew that I was a reporter who didn't, as she liked to tell people, oh, my daughter, you know, when she writes articles, she never pulls her punches. She lets them have it. And, you know, she's, you know, she investigates and finds out everything about them. So I think partly my father wanted me to do that. And I perhaps knew that if she looked at the book, she would start editing and dodging and masking and, you know, basically Photoshop my book. Right. So.
Finally, Susan, I can't let you go without asking you about this very unique moment that we live in today, where we are on the verge of possibly electing a female president for the very first time.
Let's hope we're on the verge.
And I feel like this idea of backlash is particularly appropriate today, given the vitriol. I mean, setting aside criticisms of Hillary Clinton that are valid, and there are plenty of valid criticisms of her that I spend plenty of time on in my program, but setting those aside, the kind of treatment that, say, Barack Obama faced for simply being a black man, you see that against Hillary Clinton simply for being a woman as well, which you wish wasn't true. We wish we could just criticize her for her policies. What do you think will happen if she's elected as president? Will we see this sort of macho male reactionary response to that?
Well, I'm not good at predicting the future. I don't think this kind of attitude is going to go away. I mean, it's very deeply embedded. And we're in the middle of a campaign where, on the one hand, we have this, you know, probably the, not probably, definitely the least qualified person ever to run for the president against at least one of the most qualified, maybe historically the most experienced candidate. And the fact that it's neck and neck has everything to do with gender. You can argue till the cows come home about, well, maybe she shouldn't have, you know, had her own email server. But that doesn't really explain the level of suspicion and you know, venom against her. And when you look at the language, it's all about her being this, you know, shrill, controlling, crooked, you know, corrupt, conniving figure. And I think it all goes back to the fact that despite all the progress we've supposedly made on the women's rights front, that the archetype of a woman who wants power is still a witch.
Susan Faludi, it's an honor to have you on the program. Thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
My guest is Susan Faludi, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and best-selling author of Backlash, The Undeclared War Against American Women. I spoke with her recently while she was on book tour, and we were talking about her brand new book, In the Dark Room. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can find our interviews online at risingupwithsonali.com and subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.